more like an like a painter or a musician, you know.
Era di un fascino per una diciottenne senza fine.
Aveva il senso dell'umor.
He really seems to get a jolt out of the terror.
Mi inseguiva in questa grande casa mettendomi paura. Io scappavo, ciao, ti prego, basta.
Secondo le sue tunnel?
No, mondo, no, tutto.
Argento, argento. L'argento è una cosa che ti intinna, è una cosa preziosa.
Dai, l'argento è la paura.
No, invece andiamo a squartare la gente.
Ciao, ha preso la condannata. Pronto? Vai.
Io l'avevo visto tante volte recitare, recitare della vita.
Forse, una movie, capito?
Io faccio quello che faccio perché voglio essere amato.
Ma detto, nei miei film c'è sempre la famiglia.
Nel senso, io sono mio padre, quei figli.
Io cerco il panico, che è una scatto in più, che è una penetrazione più profonda.
Hello everybody, welcome to the latest episode of Fresh Cuts. This is Mike, joining me as always, it's Mr. Venom. What's up, Venom?
Greetings and salutations, my paisano brothers. Actually, I'm not Italian. Why would they be my brothers? Anyway, whatever. How the hell are you doing, Mike?
The brotherhood of mankind.
There we go.
I'm doing pretty good. Also with us, it's Don and Ellie. What's up, Don?
Ciao, ciao, everyone. What's going on?
I had a chow chow when I was a kid. Those are great dogs.
I wanted one, but we my parents always said that they were too small. They were always afraid of them, like, being, like, stepped on or something. So we've always gotten bigger dogs.
No, a chow chow, not a chihuahua. A chow chow is a big dog. That's one of those big fluffy dogs with a purple tongue.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. I know what you're talking about now. Yeah, okay.
Big ass dog.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so this episode is going to be a little different from our normal format, because I think it's only the second time, maybe third time, we are actually discussing a documentary as opposed to just a regular old feature-length movie. Just to set the table on that, anyone that's been listening has noticed the past, two, 3 weeks, we haven't had a theatrical release, at least not wide, that we could all go see. So we've kind of been picking from VOD. And we were originally planning on doing the same thing this week. And, man, I think between the three of us, we just saw a lot of stuff that didn't really excite us. We were all kind of, like, watching movies on our own, probably to, like, see if we could come across something that was, like, conversation-worthy or at least a little bit above the fray. But, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like any of us came up with anything, like, that really separated itself from the pack.
Yeah.
So I think, what is it? Is it this week or this coming up Friday after this episode where we start
the long run of theatrical.
Yeah, yeah. So that problem should take care of itself after this episode for a while.
That also take care of the delicious crap we've gotten.
Hopefully.
I hope so.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. There's some hope in that, but, you know, it's not guaranteed either. But so the documentary we went with is one that is currently streaming on Shudder, and I would assume any Shudder subscriber is no stranger to this director, and that would be Dario Argento, and the title of the documentary is Panico, or Dario Argento Panico. And I love that title for a specific reason when it relates to the doc, which we'll get into later. But I just want to say up front, this discussion will probably go a little different because there's not really – you can't really do anything spoiler or spoiler-free. It's a documentary. They're going to talk about the director. They're going to go through his movies. Obviously, we're not going to go through his whole encyclopedia movies here. It goes without saying they talk about a lot of his movies. And get into different situations, different life stories, blah, 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 blah. So we're going to probably try to keep the discussion centered around the documentary as opposed to just going through his library. But, you know, with that said, I'm sure movies will come up in the discussion. Maybe, you know, we'll talk about our thoughts on Argento, because I don't think the three of us are any stranger to him. So, I guess we can just kind of open it up. Venom, I'll kick it to you, because I'm just it's the habit to go to you first on thoughts. Do you have any just kind of thoughts on the documentary itself, like how it was? I thought it was pretty well done personally, but what did you think of the doc?
Overall, I thought it was a fairly well done doc. It's fairly color by numbers because it goes chronologically. You know, they start from his early childhood, his parents, his grandparents, and then they go through his filmography almost in order. At 99% of the time, they're looking at the movies in chronological order. So I do appreciate that, especially somebody like me who maybe doesn't know as much about Dario on a personal level. I love Argento films. I mean, he's not my favorite Italian director. That's solidly Lucio Fulci. But I've always been a fan of Dario. Suspiria is an absolute masterpiece. It is in my top 10 horror films of all time, even though he's not my favorite Italian director. I can't deny the spectacular, just maestro-like moves that he made on that movie, both with score and with camera movement. So, yeah, Suspiria is an absolute masterpiece. As far as the documentary, like I said, I appreciate that it was done chronological. I learned a lot about the man because, like I said, I'm not very averse with his non-film life, if you will, you know, his life outside of Hollywood or the Italian Hollywood, if you will. And it was very refreshing. It was great to see just different stuff about him. Like, based on a lot of his acting performances and the interviews that he's done, I definitely would have guessed that he was kind of an extrovert, you know, a very in-your-face kind of guy. But most people say that he's a quiet, you know, introverted kind of guy. We find out in the doc that he has kind of a Stephen King style of writing in the sense that he isolates himself to write his screenplays. Obviously, Stephen King is writing novels and short stories, but it's the same thing. Stephen King kind of isolates himself to write his stories, and that's Argento's style too. He likes to put himself up in hotels away from, you know, all of his people and just write at his own leisure, and that was kind of refreshing. I was definitely, I mean, probably the most surprising thing is about his time writing Suspiria. I won't get into all of that right now because we're just doing general thoughts. We'll definitely have a discussion about that because to me that was like the most shocking thing that I learned about Argento in this documentary. But yeah, overall, you know, it just shows a man who's dedicated to his craft. Talking about his influences, people like Hitchcock and Sergio Leone and you know, great Italian and American directors as well. And it's very informative, I got to say. I've never seen a Dario Argento documentary. I know there's at least a couple of them out there. I just have never really sat down to watch one. So this one being the first of its kind for me, very informative, funny at times. Argento is definitely a lot funnier than I gave him credit for, even to this day. Like, you know, what is he, like in his 80s at this point? And he's still very sharp mentally, very funny, still has the same writing process. A lot of the movie kind of shows him writing what I think is Dark Glasses. They don't actually specifically say what movie he's writing, but that's the last movie he released, unless he has another movie coming down the pipeline that I don't know about. But just, you know, even though we don't actually see him writing ever, just to actually see how he prepares for his writing is really cool. All the information about his relationships with, you know, the woman that he married, or he was married twice, right, I believe. And then, you know, how he worked with his daughters, you know, putting both of his daughters in some of his earlier films. And then, of course, you know, working with Asia the most. I mean, they actually have kind of a prolific relationship as far as in front and behind the camera. So just all of that stuff was just really informative. It really just made me like the man more. It's nice to watch a documentary like this where we don't, you know, where we're not introduced to like skeletons in the closet, or we don't go through like their period with drug addiction and their downward spiral. It's great to see a story of an auteur, someone who's actually been dedicated to his craft since literally he was 11 years old, all the way to now. So that is just amazing. So yeah, overall, great documentary. I'm not going to sit here and say it's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. Definitely one of the better ones over the last couple of years. Definitely the best one since that Nightmare 2 documentary that we did right here on Fresh Cuts. But yeah, overall, just definitely essential viewing if you're an Argento fan, if you're a fan of his movie style, his directing style, things like that. Yeah, overall, I had a really good time with it. Sadly, it's probably my favorite movie of the year. I don't know if I could really ever make a documentary in my top 10 at the end of the year, but who knows? This could be the year. We've already talked about how 2024 has been, let's just say, disappointing, to say the least. So, yeah, overall, I had a great time with this documentary. I actually watched it twice before we recorded, and yeah, just really enjoyed it. I actually like Asia a little bit more now after hearing her talk about her father and talk about how much she reveres him and how much she learned from him and everything else. So yeah, overall, just a very eye-opening documentary for someone like me who's never seen one before and didn't really know a lot about the man outside of his movies. So yeah, highly recommend from me. Definitely should check this one out.
All right, I'll kick it over to Dawn on your thoughts on the doc.
Yeah, I can say that I would probably be the one that's the most familiar with his work out of the three of us. I would probably say that I've only missed one film of his. I have yet to see Phantom of the Opera, the 98 one. I think that's the only one of his that I'm missing. Although I could probably stand to revisit some of the work post Stendhal syndrome, though that's the stuff that I'm not as sharp on. I mean, his classic era, I pretty much know fairly well. Like, it's not really gonna, you know, evoke a lot of surprises or anything like that. But like the more modern stuff that I've probably seen maybe once or twice, not as familiar. But I'm kind of like Venom. I do prefer Fulci over Argento, but I think Argento's the better filmmaker. And I also have Suspiria in my top 10 of all time as well. So I have that, although I put Tenebrae just slightly above Suspiria. That one's in my top 5. And Tenebrae's in my top 5, and Suspiria's in my top 10. So I have them just slightly above each other, but... Mm. Yeah, it was still a pretty fun time. I have seen one Argento documentary. I believe it was called An Eye for Horror, which came out, I want to say it came out for the filming of Trauma, because they spent a lot of time talking with Savini and how he did the effects in that one. So I want to say that it came out right around the time Trauma, which was 92, 93. So there's the other ones I've seen. If you want to count made for like specific documentaries that were made for various physical media releases, I don't know that, like, you know, you could say that those count just because they're not widely available or accessible, and they're isolated to a specific release. But yeah, it was still pretty fun to, you know, dive into his background. Not a lot of that was pretty familiar. I knew a lot about it. But yeah, it was still a pretty interesting watch. I like the way that they did it, where there was one that was really cool where they kind of intercut one of his old interviews with him talking in the modern day, and it was kind of like they were finishing each other's sentences where. It didn't feel like he was like, I want to say, you know, reciprocating the same idea, but it felt like he was saying the same thing. So it was like he still felt the same way. So the idea of like putting the two different clips together kind of, it had like a really interesting touch to, I think he was talking about Inferno, wasn't he? Or maybe we'll talk about, I want to say it was Inferno, but I don't remember specifically, but either way, I mean, it was still a lot of fun. I like the way it came off. He's always been a really fun guy to listen to. I still have a lot of various packages that have interviews or documentaries on them just because they're not, you know, ported over to newer releases. So, yeah, it's always fun to hear him talk. I love going into it. You know, he's one of my favorite talkers, even though, you know, a lot of it's subtitled and you have to, you know, read what he's saying. But I still really enjoy him, and I still came away with, you know, there was a few things that I did learn that I can't say were, you know, new or, you know, I hadn't heard before. So I think that's kind of what you want with these kinds of things, where, you know, you at least learn something new, even if you're, you know, intimately familiar with the topic. So, yeah, kudos to that. Is it top 10 of the year? I mean, that's an argument. That's an argument. yeah, I can't say I disagree. yeah, that's definitely a conversation to be had. As sad as it sounds and as hilarious as it is. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I probably would be the most familiar with this work. And I mean, I came away learning something. So I guess that's kind of like, you know, the whole point. So, you know, kudos on the job. You know, stick around. Please finish. If that's a new movie, please finish whatever you're doing. Because as much as I enjoyed Dark Glasses, I at least want one more shot at a masterpiece. So like I said, if Dark Glasses is his last one, oh, please, thank you, God, for allowing you to finish that and not give us Dracula. But if you can do one more, I do want to have another shot at the masterpiece. So, like I said, if you give us Dark Glasses as the last one, I'm so eternally thankful for that you at least gave us something enjoyable. But if you have one more in us and you're able to grace us with another potential masterpiece, I do want that one. So if you can finish whatever this piece is, if this is Star Glasses, then, you know, kudos. But if this is a new piece, I would want us one more shot at a masterpiece. But, yeah, overall, I can't really say much else without going into spoilers. So I guess that's pretty much it for me.
Hey, Don, I got a question. Being the Argento expert of the group. Well, I know Suspiria, Inferno, and what is it, Tenebrae? They are
Mother of Tears.
Mother of Tears.
Now,
Mother of Tears.
Yep.
Or excuse me, Mother of Tears.
Yeah.
Did Argento know when he was making Suspiria that it was always planned that way, or did that come after? Because I know when you watch Inferno, it's pretty apparent because, like, there's the three books, there's references to, like, the three. But, like, from memory on Suspiria, I can't remember them referencing, like, other witches outside of, like, just, like, what's happening at that specific dance school. So was it always planned that way, or?
I don't remember if he ever intentionally planned to do it back-to-back the way he did. But there is mention of there's a sequence in it. I think it's the Udo Kier sequence where he's talking with Susie about the various witches and how they were confined to various locations. You could potentially argue that that is setting the seeds for a franchise. I can't imagine that it would have been apparent back then. You know, the way we think of franchises nowadays, I can't imagine that mentality would have been apparent back then. Although I can very easily say, you know, okay, if this is successful, you laid the seeds with this one line or, you know, this particular sequence, because it's a line that he drops in the course of the whole conversation. But there is this there is a mentality that can, you know, you can retcon it and say, okay, if this was successful enough, here's the groundwork that we have for more entries in this particular saga. And that's kind of what you get with Inferno, where it does, it, you know, Inferno does directly tie back and it references Suspiria. So since there's a gap between the two, between the releases, because Suspiria is 77 and Inferno is 1980, there is a chance that Argento went back and tied the threads together. But I don't think he would have ever planned to do a trilogy because he never mentions the third one. He mentions that there's three, but he mentions that there's three, and then Inferno's the second one. But he never specifically mentions what the third one is. So I don't know if that would have been planning a trilogy or if it was just, okay, this is successful, give us a follow-up.
Yeah, they definitely mention the Mother of Sighs and the Mother of Tears in the original, in Suspiria. So there is mention of the three mothers. I can't imagine he was planning a trilogy. Why would he wait so long to do the third entry, too? I don't know. And on top of the fact that the third entry is probably the worst.
I prefer Inferno. I prefer Mother of Tears over Inferno.
Do you really? Wow. Yeah. I love Mother of Tears. I mean, Mother of Tears is easily the most violent of the trilogy, but I just remember the way, man, how can I put it? The first time I saw Inferno, which was probably only the third Argento movie I had ever seen, that was the movie that where I was like, okay, this guy's an artist. This guy's not just a film director. This dude's a legit maestro of what he does. And nothing wrong with that. Hey, like I said, I'm not saying you're wrong and I'm right by any stretch of the imagination.
I know I'm in the minority. But.
Oh yeah, guaranteed. Hey, we all are in one way or another. I am a little. I was just surprised by the statement. That's all.
No worries. I get it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what's funny. After the doc, I actually watched Inferno because it started to autoplay, and I was gonna stop it. Because I hadn't planned to, like, watch a movie right after. But I was like, yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen Inferno. So I think that's why it was kind of fresh in my head with when they referenced the books. And, like they clearly kind of pronounce it, like, let's just say, hey, make it seem like, oh, we're going to get a third one eventually. But, so, yeah, that's what made me ask. So as far as the doc goes, yeah, I mean, I echo a lot of what's already been said. Some of my favorite features of it, which I like in all documentaries when it comes to like a director or writer or just filmmaker, I love when they talk to the peers, especially kind of like the generations that came after, and you get the stories of like their first experience with Argento and kind of like their interpretation of his style and maybe like lessons or techniques they took and used or just how impressed they were the first time or how it like affected their zeitgeist and like how they wanted to make movies. I know Del Toro's in this, Gaspar Noé's in this. I forgot there's another director, I just forgot his name. And then like Venom's. He's there too. There was someone else
There was that one American guy, Neffin. I'm not sure what he does, but he was in the doc a lot.
Isn't he the guy that did Neon Demon?
Maybe. I love that movie, but I don't know the director.
That felt like very Argento.
I haven't seen it since it came out. I could swear I thought that was his.
It might be. If I had to guess, I would have said Gaspar Noé for that one, just because it looks like a Noé film, but I mean, that totally makes sense that it's, there's a reason that they're speaking to this director, so it makes sense that it would be Neon Demon, because Neon Demon definitely looks like a modern Argento film through various scenes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I also love the stories of when he was, like, kind of a new and a younger filmmaker, and of course, like, you know, the ruling Italian filmmakers at the time might have scoffed at, like, oh, who's this Argento guy? And then, like, as soon as they see his movies, they're like, oh, yeah, never mind. He's actually going to be pretty good, probably. I love there's a story in it of them going to see Alien when they were in America and loving the hell out of that. I was like, yes, that rules. But yeah, like overall, like Venom said, it's pretty chronological. The thing about documentaries like this that's going to span his career, it's like, unless you're going to do something for like with a 3-hour running time, they're going to have to skip through certain sections. Because the thing to keep in mind, this isn't a documentary on any specific Argento movie. So they're like, it's like a, what the hell, what term am I looking for? It's almost bittersweet because like they'll move on to like a certain movie and you're like, oh shit, here we go. And then like, you know, they got to move like right on along to the next one. But, you know, I still think they do an overall pretty good job with everything. I loved hearing Aja Argento's interviews about everything because I think she had great insight. And just actually anyone in his family, because the other sister was pretty good too. I love the stories about how much family oriented he is and how when the daughters went to go live with him full time, you know, they'd always be around the sets naturally, and they seem to pick up a lot of stuff about film from him. And what I think perhaps my favorite bit in the whole documentary was when Argento, and maybe it's a coincidence that the documentary is titled Panico or Panic. I love the way he kind of broke down the fact that he kind of feels the emotion of panic to be like just as intense as like being scared or something being scary, because I know this conversation comes up all the time in the horror community, especially for like us older horror fans. It's like, at this age, what really still scares you? And sometimes it's hard to come up with an answer, but when I was watching this doc and Argento was talking about like making the audience have the emotion of panic, I still feel like I get that emotion from a good horror movie. I might not be scared, but that emotion of panic, I think that can translate to like at any age, at any time. If you write well and put your characters in the right situation, I will feel panicked on the behalf of the characters just as much now as when I was like a new horror fan watching things for the first time. So I thought that was like brilliantly explained by him, and that's probably one of the reasons he is who he is, because being able to lay it out like that was just magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, that is such a valid statement, because I mean, going back to the recent past, all three of our number one movie from 2023, When Evil Lurks. Like, I wouldn't go so far as to say anything scared me, but let me tell you something. That dog attack, I felt that panic that Argento is talking about. It just came out of nowhere, and it's so violent. You just don't expect to see this beautiful little girl get whipped around by this dog. So, yeah, panic is definitely something that I still feel. Fear, you know, after 40-plus years of watching horror movies, what's really scary anymore? You know, short of someone in real life pointing a gun at me, I just don't know what's truly scary anymore. But yeah, panic, that's something that I still definitely feel. I felt it during Hereditary. I felt it during The Dark of the Wicked. And most recently, I felt it during When Evil Lurks. So, yeah, I love that conversation as well.
I figured that may have been a spoiler. I was going to mention the same thing, but I didn't. That's the thing. I didn't know if we were going to dive into spoilers already, but yeah, I completely agree. But no, I'm just saying is that I completely agree. I think there's a difference between panic and fear, where you're concerned for somebody and you're panicked because you can't help them. But then because you're desensitized to it, you're not exactly, you know, scared for them. You want to help them, but you're not exactly scared, if that makes sense. Yeah,
exactly. I it's like if you were there, you could act, but you're just an audience member in front of a screen, so there's nothing you can do about it. Yeah, like if you were there during that dog attack, hell yeah, I would have helped that little girl. I'm not just going to sit there and watch it happen, but yeah, absolute 100% on the panic issue. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, what else generally did I have to say, even though I did get into some details, but yeah, I just love kind of following his career. Like, the thing I love about Argento, or that's something that I've really come to respect, is like he takes words off the script page and really turns it into art. Like, because I always think about when I watch like a horror movie. Now, obviously, like if I had to compare, because I was like, what can I compare it to? So you give me a script for like Friday the 13th. Obviously, you know, I'm not a filmmaker. I'm not going to make a movie as good as Friday the 13th, as good as, you know, Cunningham did. So I'm not trying to make that statement. But I think generally, like with a script for Friday the 13th, you would get a Friday the 13th movie. But you give me like Suspiria script, I would never in my wildest dreams be able to come up with like the artistic nature of what Argento like got out of it. You know, I would probably come up with like the plainest Jane movie about a chick going to a school and there's witches, and you know, other than the plot itself, I would
into
not.
The remake.
Oh God, I hope. Well, that, then hopefully that would be my first and last movie ever directed. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, and that's not a knock on like Friday the 13th, because I love Friday the 13th too, and for different reasons. But I just think like, because I feel a similar way about Brian De Palma, especially early in his career. Like that, he took like a story like Carrie, and I think he elevated that material with just his filming style, like the split screen, the colors, the cinematography. Like that's all stuff that comes out to me with a director's vision of like what they want to do with the story, and I think that's what makes Argento special. The Argento-Fulci like debate, it's a tough one for me, because I think I've answered Fulci before, but it's like tough because like it might just be like what mood I'm in on the particular day. Fulci, I feel like he has a lot of my personal favorites, but when I kind of like pull back and just look at like the skill, like the actual skill in the filmmaking and like the complete package you get with each director, I might start to say Argento is the better filmmaker. Fulci just has personal favorites.
Argento's a better technician. Argento's a better technician. Yeah. Fulci's more of a commercial director. That's just because of his background, though. Because Fulci was a journeyman. He did pretty much everything before he became the horror fan. He didn't really become a horror fan until I think his first film he actually directed was in 1959, and he didn't do full-on horror until 1979. So he had a full 2 decades plus before he was actually – I mean, you can probably say his giallos in the early 70s could be considered horror, but he didn't do zombie until 79. So he had already been a genuine technician, because he did comedies, he did dramas, he did slapstick, he did musicals. He did spaghetti westerns, he did, you know, giallos like Argento did, but it was because that was the style at the time. That was what he could, that he was just basically a guy that was, oh, you need somebody to direct it, let me do it. And that wasn't what Argento was. Argento was a craftsman. He was the one that, you know, he had more of a personal impact on his films, and he has a distinct style to his films. And Fulci, for all that he does, he's much more of a journeyman. If you look at him technically, he's pretty much just a generic but extremely effective filmmaker. He doesn't have, you know, personal stories. He doesn't have any of the, you know, the technical wherewithal that Argento does. He's much more personal with his work, and Fulci's a little bit more, you know, for lack of a better term, standoffish and, you know, okay, we're gonna be efficient, and we're gonna, you know, cut to the basics of what we want to do. But he doesn't have his own personal style. He doesn't have his own unique stamp the way Argento does.
Yeah, the way I look at it, Fulci makes the more fun movies. On any given day, I'd probably rather watch a Fulci movie because it's more geared towards what I like to watch. You know, the quote unquote more fun movie. Argento makes the more cerebral movie. The movie that might make you think, the movie that really makes you look at all the red herrings in his giallos and try to decide who's the actual killer and their motivations and things like that, you know? Not to say that Argento's movies aren't fun, not at all, but over the course of an entire filmography, I would say that Fulci's the more, you know, he makes the more fun movies, Argento makes the more cerebral ones. And that's not a knock on Argento by any stretch of the imagination. The man—I've already called the man an auteur like 4 times, and I'll probably say it at least 4 more. So yeah.
Yeah, I love the fact that like Argento, because when it comes to the giallo genre, it can be hard to get people into it because a lot of them can the movies can come off as like dry, you know, a little dry, a little deliberate in their presentation. But Argento just makes them fun. Like sometimes, like the plots aren't always the most complicated, but they're just fun to watch. They're fun to watch. They're fun to experience. They're fun to go to the theater and just listen to the score. Speaking of Claudio Simonetti, Simonetti, he was heavily featured in the documentary too, which was awesome because the scores, a lot of them from Goblin in Argento movies. Those are like almost half the fun of Argento movies. I was fortunate. I got to go see Goblin live last year, and they played the score of a movie, and then afterwards they played a bunch, like kind of a grab bag of different stuff they've done for not just Argento, but like Romero and other horror movies. And hearing Deep Red live was just like ridiculous. Like it was something that like a decade ago, I would never have even thought the opportunity would happen because they weren't doing that. Well, I don't want to say they weren't, but it wasn't as easy to get to, especially outside of like, you know, a few big cities. But the fact that like they did like a full blown tour, and I thought it was funny because Argento was like originally looking at like Pink Floyd or Deep Purple, according to the doc, to like score some movies and. Well, just imagine like how much more that probably would have cost them too, like to try to nab one of those.
On top of the fact that bands like Deep Purple and Pink Floyd are going to want to have final say on their own music, they're not really going to work well with a composer like Argento. Whereas if you bring in, you know, a more indie band like Goblin, they're going to be a little bit more receptive to instruction. So yeah, a Goblin was the perfect choice. And Deep Purple, I don't even know what the hell he was thinking about. That would have been the worst choice for the score of Deep Red.
Well, it would have been during the Coverdale era. It wouldn't have been during...
Granted,
it would have been during their psychedelic era. It's not a far-off stretch, but if you're familiar with, you know, like Machine Head era, then okay, yeah, maybe it wouldn't exactly work. But, I mean, during their psychedelic era...
I mean, I did listen to the Glenn Hughes era, a lot of it. So, I mean, I'm mildly familiar with it. I'm definitely more familiar with ultra early Deep Purple and then 80s and beyond Deep Purple, because I actually was a big fan of Deep Purple in the 80s, that version of Deep Purple. I missed out on a lot of the psychedelic stuff, but I do remember owning one or two of those records. Yeah, vinyl. Awesome. back in the day. So I don't know. It's just... I even in their psychedelic period, I just didn't feel like they utilized keyboards and synthesizers the way that Goblin eventually did. So, I mean, you know, I'm not going to just dispel it completely. I mean, who knows? Maybe in some weird multiverse, Deep Purple did do the score, and it's actually better. Who knows? But I just – you have to realize – and I haven't said this yet, and I guess I'll say it now – Deep Red is my favorite Argento movie, and it is easily 40% the score. That is easily my favorite Argento score. It's the only one that I actually own. I have it on vinyl. I pop it on at least every 6 months or so. I adore that score. I absolutely love it. I saw the same show that Mike saw. Obviously, I saw it in L.A., and being able to see one of my favorite, probably a top five horror movie score performed live, I mean, it was as exciting as the first time I got to see John Carpenter perform all his themes live, you know? So, yeah, Deep Red for me is – I'm not going to sit here and say Deep Red's his best movie because it's objectively not his best movie. But it is my favorite one to watch, and like I said, easily it's 40% that score. Long live Goblin.
Yeah, I think that's what I agree. Deep Red, it's one of the it's almost like an experience because of the score. It feels I think most of his movies are scored pretty well, but there's something in the way that Deep Red feels like it just uses the score and pushes the score as like a character in the movie almost, and it's just so good, and it's so pronounced, it's so emphasized heavily as you're watching the movie that it feels like a symbiotic relationship when it comes to Deep Red. And, and it's like the thing is, like, if Pink Floyd or Deep Purple would have scored some of the movies, I can't say that the scores would be bad, but there's something that was – I think you alluded to it, Venom. It was the collaborative aspect between Goblin that you might not have got if you had, like, a bigger, huge band that already was up their own ass. And justifiably so, because it's not like those bands are bad. They're legendary bands, but you almost – I think it probably did benefit that, like, Goblin was a little more under the radar. They were an Italian prog rock band, not an American prog rock band. So it probably just helped and it formed, like, the perfect union for these movies, and it worked so well. So I was glad that he was featured a lot in the documentary.
Absolutely. I think about the only band that I could think of that I would have liked to have heard them do an Argento score is King Crimson. I don't know how familiar you guys are with King Crimson, but they're another great prog rock band from the 60s and 70s that a very different kind of prog rock than what Goblin was doing, but it very, like, avant-garde, if you will. I mean, for you, for lack of a better term. That's one band I definitely would be interested to hear their version of an Argento score. But, you know, all we can do is dream.
Yeah.
Now, I will say another reason I really like this doc is that my favorite director of all time is in it, and he gets to speak about it. And that is, of course, Guillermo del Toro. If anybody doesn't know, del Toro is my favorite director, regardless of genre. I tend to give Carpenter the nod if you're asking me specifically about horror, but Argento is just an absolute maestro of cinema. And to hear him talk about Argento and his world building and how people will accept crazy stuff, like the opening of Inferno and how just absolutely nutty it is. People will just accept it because it's Argento. Nobody questions it. He had in the documentary, he had the example of the girl living on a glass mountain. And it's true. If Argento opened one of his movies with a girl living on a mountain of glass, we wouldn't question it because it's fucking Argento. You know, it's just part of that world. And we love it and we accept it. His world building is just amazing, and it really, really, really got, especially during, Suspiria, Inferno, Opera, late 70s, early 80s, man, his world building was stellar. So, yeah. So to hear Guillermo talk about him and talk about all the things that he's done that inspired him, of course, I'm always down to listen to Guillermo, even though you don't always understand everything Guillermo says if you speak in English. He's pretty goddamn awesome to listen to. He's probably like Argento is Don's favorite director to hear talk. For me, it's Guillermo. I could listen to Guillermo for hours, and even in Spanish. I listen to his Spanish interviews too. I of course am Spanish, so I actually prefer his Spanish interviews because he's much more comfortable, much more fluid, and his stories come off a lot quicker and pithier, if you will. I love listening to Argento talk, and everything he said in this movie was just absolutely great. Everything he talked about with Argento.
Yeah, I think he alluded to him being like, it's almost like a fairy tale in nature when you're watching Argento.
And that's
accurate. You just kind of accept things, and there doesn't need to be any explanation. It just is because it is. And the same way like fairy tales work is just you read the setup and you just accept it and move along to the next part.
Yeah, absolutely. There was one segment in this that kind of left me scratching my head. It was the What's in Your Pocket segment.
They did a
segment in here where there's an interview with Argento from the late 70s. He still has his long hair, so it's a very old interview. And the interviewer asks him, what's in your pockets right now? Which, I don't know, that's an odd question. Like, if I was Argento, I don't know if I'd have answered it. I'd have been like, fuck you, that's none of your damn business what's in my pockets. But being the great guy that he is, he goes ahead and empties out his pockets. And then they redo that scene in modern times, like with Argento, you know, writing his most current film. They do the same thing, what's in your pocket? And, of course, it's modernized because there's, like, a cell phone in there. There's, like, a garage remote control type stuff. But I'm like, why did I need to know what's in Argento's pocket? Like, it just felt like they were filling time. I don't know. Maybe I missed something. I don't know.
Well, it's like, what do they expect, black gloves and a knife to be in there?
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah, you think he's going to pull out, like, a mask and a film reel? Like, what do you think this man carries in his pockets? I will say that I thought even though it is a little bit sexist and maybe not something that would be done today, I did enjoy the bra story from Opera. If you guys remember his female lead in Opera, the Spanish actress, he apparently wanted her in the film with like a very sheer white dress on and no bra on, basically to the point where you could basically see her breasts because it was a very sheer dress. The actress apparently refused to take off her bra, and then Argento didn't speak to her for the whole rest of the goddamn production. And I'm thinking, how the hell did you give her direction? Did you, like, have your assistant director just give her? But I just – obviously, that's not something that would be done today, or at least not admitted publicly, because that comes off as very sexist. But I don't know. Something about it just – it made me laugh that this – you know, this actress took a stand and said, no, I'm not going to show my boobs in your movie. And then he's like, fine, I'm not talking to you anymore. Almost like he was a child. I found it, and they talk about that. They talk about at various points in the documentary that Argento is basically a big teenager. That he's always, you know, he's very bubbly. He's got a lot of energy. Blah blah blah. He's very passionate about his craft and the people that he works with. But I don't know. I don't know why that bra story tickled me, but it absolutely did. And it was great to see that actress too, because I actually didn't realize she was Spanish until she started speaking Spanish. And I'm like, hey, I don't need the subtitles. That's awesome. And then her story at the end of her segment was very contradictory. I don't know if you guys really paid attention to it, but she talks about how she appreciates Argento, that he did a lot for her and, you know, helped her career, helped her acting style. But then she'll end the conversation with, oh yeah, he was very cold to me. He didn't really speak directly to me. And it's like, which is it? Like, you're being contradictory in your single statement. Obviously, she has a reverence for some kind of, you know, she cares about the man in some way, shape, or form. He obviously did something for her career. So there's a sense of appreciation there. But I think it's almost like she was sugarcoating not having the greatest time on that production. You know, because it's Argento. He's, you know, a film master. I don't want to speak badly about him. Because I mean, I don't know if you guys got that impression. Like, even the looks on her face, like, it seemed like she wanted to say some negative stuff, but just was like, nah, I'll hold it in. I don't know. Maybe it was just me. I don't know if you guys got that impression.
I knew that she didn't have the best working experience. The funny thing is that she actually came off on a different interview. I believe it's on the Anchor Bay DVD. But she was really pissed off at him because they were doing one of the stunts, and I believe there's like some – it wasn't a mishap, but there was just a slight miscalculation with one of the pyro effects, and she ended up getting like mildly burned as a result of it. I think it's on the DVD. I didn't have enough time to check it out, but I think it's on an interview there where she mentions that she had it wasn't like a catastrophic incident, and it wasn't one that resulted in like a lot of delays or anything, but there was an incident, and I remember it was something to do with a pyro sequence, and she ended up being like slightly burned as a result. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not one where she's like one of those where, you know, she's always going to speak bad about him, but it's one where I think a lot of people that are intimately familiar know that she's not one of his favorite she's not one of his, like, you know, favorite collaborators, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's what I mean. This is what documentaries are for. This is the kind of information that I would have never had before. And now that I have it, you know, it kind of opens my eyes a little bit more about, you know, actor-director relationships. I've never been either. I've never acted. I've never directed. I've only done sound work on film productions. So that's really all I know. But just to see more about these different relationships that he had with his starlets. And even early on in the doc, when he's talking about how he filmed his women, and how his mother, being a famous photographer of the stars in Italy, how her work influenced the way that he shot women and the way that he screened women for his movies, too. There's a quick scene in the movie where he's auditioning a couple of different women who are all amazingly beautiful, but obviously, you know, he's looking for that certain something in his actresses. So, yeah, just more great. And that leads back to the influence of his parents, you know, his mother being a photographer for the stars. And, of course, his father being Salvatore, who was, you know, a famous Italian producer and film distributor. So, obviously, you know, this is definitely – it's almost like the family business. And even – I also love the story of how he got his first job. Like, literally at 18, he became a critic for the local newspaper because he wanted to do something in entertainment so badly. And obviously, no one's going to let an 18-year-old direct a major film or be like an assistant director or anything. But to hear the story of him getting into the newspaper and then how that turned into reviewing movies and then how that turned into, you know, just more writing opportunities until he finally got a chance to actually write a screenplay, which was his foot in the door into the, you know, the film industry. That's another fascinating aspect of his career that I wouldn't have known about otherwise. So, yeah, like I said, very eye-opening for me, lots of new information. And then he has one quote in this movie that really stuck with me, and he says it right towards the end of the documentary. The quote, and I quote exactly, the quote is, "I do what I do because I want to be loved." Most directors would never admit that. Most directors would just be like, oh, I make it for the sake of the art, or I make it because the art makes me happy, or blah, blah, blah. But to actually hear this great, masterful director actually say that he does this because he wants to be loved, it's so genuine that even though it may sound selfish to some people, it's such a genuine statement that it really speaks to Argento as not just a director, but as a human being. And I love that quote. I really do. A lot of people are probably, like I said, a lot of people are going to hear that quote and think that he's being selfish, that he just wants to be loved and wants fame and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, nah, that's genuine, man. And not just movie makers. Like, I was a musician for over 20 years in my life, and we made music to make other people happy. I wanted the people that came to our shows and bought our CDs to be happy with our music, which then in turn you know, leads to fame and fortune and everything else. So, like I said, just to hear him actually say those words was so refreshing and so genuine. This documentary just makes me love Argento even more. So, yeah, I love that quote.
Yeah, I'm running out of things to say just because I think we've covered, like, a lot
just about.
Okay, well then I guess real quick, rapid fire thoughts on his films.
I'm sorry. There was one thing I wanted to discuss real quick before. I'm very sorry. The one shocking thing that I discovered in this film, apparently during the writing of Suspiria, Argento had suicidal thoughts to the point where he literally had like a large bay window in the hotel because, you know, once again, he isolated himself in a hotel to write Suspiria. And I guess they had this big, large window in his bedroom. And he said multiple times during the writing of Suspiria, he thought about just leaping from the window. And he was very open about it. You know, he wasn't sugarcoating anything. And the funny thing is that he was not depressed. He was actually happy. Like, his films were doing well. He was getting buku money to write and make Suspiria. His family life was doing fairly well. I mean, he had been divorced a couple of years earlier, but, I mean, for the most part, he was enjoying life. You know, he said he had lots of girlfriends, but that he still had thoughts of suicide. And that was odd to me. Because obviously when you hear about someone having thoughts of suicide, instantly you think, oh, they're depressed. They have, you know, they have maybe some kind of mental health issue, depression, anxiety, whatever the case may be. But to hear a man say, no, my life was great, but whenever I would look in this look through this window, I would contemplate leaping from it. And that story was really, like dark to me, you know? And eventually he said that he did tell one of his producers or one of his writing partners, I forget which, about the thoughts that he was having, and they came up with the idea of putting, like, a wardrobe and a desk and a chair blocking the window so that he doesn't even contemplate those thoughts, and it worked. They blocked the window, and he said he never had any more thoughts of suicide after that. So it's like, was this a haunted window or what? Like, what makes a happy man want to jump out a window? That was probably the most shocking thing I learned in this one, you know? I mean, hey, yeah. We've probably all had suicidal thoughts at times, you know, different levels of depression that we've gone through at different stages in our life. But to hear a man say that he was happy and that his life was going well, but that he still almost threw himself out a window, yeah, that definitely, it shook me a little bit, actually. I'll admit it. It absolutely shook me. And to think, I mean, what would the world have lost if this man actually leapt out that window back in 1976? Oh, my God, we would have lost so much. Oh, Jesus. Thank you, Dario, for not doing that.
Or thank you, the producer, for putting the block up.
Yeah, thank you for – well, I mean, at least Dario was smart enough to share. You know, he didn't – a lot of people who are depressed will keep those feelings in. And,
right,
and
yeah.
You know, they feel like they have to deal with it themselves, that it's nobody else's problem. But the fact that he shared those feelings with somebody, again, it just shows the kind of person that he is, that he's open, that he's honest. He wears his heart on his sleeve, and that's commendable, absolutely, especially in the Hollywood that we live in now, definitely.
Yeah, I think the way he kind of framed or described it, it's interesting. It's probably like comes off real for a lot of people, because like he didn't really describe it as like, you know, any type of like long onset depression. It was more just like a feeling that can creep up on you at the damnedest of times, even when things are going well. And I think a lot of people, when they describe when they get feelings of depression or even like suicide, unfortunately, they say the same thing. Like it's not always like a linear thing where like, oh, first you get down and then depressed and then suicidal. Things can be going like normal or well, and it's just something like a feeling that can overtake you like quickly. So I thought that was interesting because I had no idea that he had ever had those thoughts either, to be honest. Yeah,
definitely. Definitely eye-opening. But again, it just humanizes him, you know? I mean, we all look at Argento as this, you know, he's up on a pedestal. He's one of the greatest horror directors. Hell, he's one of the greatest directors, period, ever. We put him on a pedestal, but to hear him have these very human thoughts that a lot of us have, again, it just makes you love him even more. God damn, this guy is great. And like I said, you know, no sexual assault charges, no bouts with drug or alcohol addiction. You know, it was just a very positive documentary, and I love that. Even with the suicide talk, there was a certain positivity to it, you know? And, yeah, this whole thing was great. Talking about it's actually making me like this a lot more.
Well, that, and it makes me just want to go watch, like, rewatch Argento movies, because –
yep.
I've seen a good number of them, but some of them I haven't seen in a while. So it's like, man, because as a doc's going through them, you see like the ambiance, the color, the sound, and it's like, man, it makes me think like, as much as I already like them, it's like, man, I must have missed even more stuff in them that I need to go rewatch and experience again. Especially, I have like a few of them on 4K now, and I'm just like, man, I just, like, especially Deep Red, I just want to throw it on and turn my sound system, like, way up.
Oh, that's you know, a 4K just... that I need. I need that one. I just picked up Bird with the Crystal Plumage recently, and I haven't watched that, and it's probably been about 20, 25 years, literally, since I've watched it. So I'm thinking about popping it in tonight, because I think we're all in an Argento mood at this point.
Yeah, I grabbed that one and Cat of Nine Tails at the same time, because they were... I can't remember if they're from Arrow or...
Yeah, they are.
Arrow was having a sale, and I picked them up both at Christmas time. So I have those and Ooh. Suspiria and Deep Red on 4K. So I'm like, man...
Yeah.
That's you just named one of my shames of horror. I've never seen Cat and Nine Tails. I have to rectify it. I mean, it's one of his early ones, and I have to see it. You know, just because I love all his early movies, and that's the only early one that I've never seen. That's the only one pre Stendhal syndrome that I haven't seen. So yeah, I'll have to sit down and watch it.
Tom, go ahead. I'll ask you the question after.
Well, I was going to say, Cat is probably the weakest of those films, so I wouldn't say that that's a pressing priority, but I understand where you're coming from. I would just say that, you know, if you've got other stuff to watch, it's probably not pressing to get to that immediately.
Sure. And then one last thank you to the to the documentary filmmakers. Thanks for skipping Dracula.
Oh, I almost didn't catch that. Yeah, good point.
Don, what are your thoughts on Four Flies on Grey Velvet?
I actually really like that. I think that one's pretty fun. You have to get past some really hokey science. You have to get past some really hokey science, but I really like it. The central mystery is not bad. There's some fun chase sequences. And I think it's probably this may sound like the weirdest part, but it's probably his funniest. It's not a flat out comedy, but I do think it's the one where he actually injected enough comedy in it to be funny.
I'm kicking myself because when it released on 4K, I still kind of wasn't in my full on like, oh, I'm buying movies again mode, and it must have gone, because now you can still find it, but like the price is ridiculous. But luckily someone put like an HD quality rip of it on YouTube, so like I might just watch it, because I don't want to spend like I think last time I saw it was like over like $100 the 4K. So I'm waiting for like maybe they'll do like a re-release or like another pressing of it, and I'll grab it right away as soon as they do.
Yeah, same here.
But I just don't want to wait to watch it. Like, I want to watch it.
Yeah, same here. That's one I missed as well. Because I own the Arrow 4Ks of Bird, Cat, and Deep Red. I have the... give me one second here, because I have just about everything. Just give me one second here. Let me actually look at myself, and I can...
In Two Evil Eyes, which story is Argento's and which is Romero's?
Argento's the first one. He's the Black Cat.
Black Cat, thank you. Cool.
Okay, yeah. I've got Arrow of Bird, Cat, and Deep Red. I don't have the 4K version, but I have the first pressing of the Suspiria from Synapse. But I do have the Synapse 4Ks of Tenebrae and Phenomena. I have the first pressing from, I think it's Ronan Flicks, of Opera. I have the Vinegar Syndrome version of Tenebrae. And I have the Blue Underground 3-disc version of Stendhal. Nice. Those are the Blu-rays. And then on DVD, I have, the Anchor Bay 5-pack of Argento, which has... it has Tenebrae, Phenomena, Trauma, Card Player, and Do You Like Hitchcock? And then I also have a DVD of Giallo.
Nice.
So, yeah, that's my Argento collection.
So, after listing all the movies, I think the only Argento I've never seen is Cat and Nine Tails and The Card Player. And I am a poker player. Why the hell have I not sat down and watched The Card Player yet?
Card Player is actually pretty fun. I like it.
Is it? Okay, I gotta seek that out then.
Yeah, it's not bad. I kind of like it. I also should mention that I have a VHS of Sleepless, but I haven't upgraded from there. That was one I missed. But I also own Sleepless on VHS. I think that's by Troma. I'd have to dig that one out and find out. Because I know that they were involved with it. They uploaded a really crappy copy of it, so that's why I haven't upgraded it for a while. But yeah, I think the VHS I have is of Sleepless. But anyways, with CartPlayer, it's much better than you think it is. Yeah, maybe you'd probably get into it a little bit more because it lies very heavily on poker playing.
Ooh, oh, I'm in.
Yeah, because that's actually one of the gimmicks is that the killer has a private room and plays poker with the detective. And if the killer wins, then he kills. If the detective wins, then he lets the victim go.
Oh my God, I'm watching this tonight. Wow. Why have I slept on this? Holy shit.
Yeah, like I said, Card Player is pretty fun. You may like it a little bit more just because of how well it goes into that. But uh-huh. Yeah, it's actually better than you think it is. It's a little ropey at the end, but I think you'll enjoy it.
Nice.
But yeah, like I said, that's my general collection.
Sweet. All right, well, let's see.
I'm looking for my notes, and yeah, it's pretty much all I got.
Yeah, I think that's probably it. I mean, obviously, if we just wanted to talk about Argento's movies themselves, we could keep going for hours because there's so many and there's so much to talk about with most of them. But yeah, I guess, yeah, we'll probably leave it there. Like I said at the beginning, this is streaming on Shudder, so anyone with a Shudder sub should be able to watch it anytime. And hey, I mean, I think it's even good if you're not familiar because with a lot of his movies, because you get enough out of each movie to kind of give you like a little taste or a flavor of what his movies are all about without spoiling too much. They don't really reveal like killers or anything or the twist, the mystery.
Yeah, it's really good about being like an introductory piece. I mean, yeah, like you were saying, it just gives you like basic backgrounds. I'm pretty sure that I think the most in depth it actually does is it just gives you a plot synopsis. But yeah, it's really good as like a introductory piece because like I said, the only other one I've seen is Dario Argento and Eye for Horror, and that was done back with Trauma. So it doesn't have anything. It doesn't have anything post because it came out like 92, 93. So yeah, it's missing Stendhal, it's missing Phantom, which you know I've heard is you know for the best, but I haven't seen it, so I can't say. But yeah, it misses Sleepless, Card Player, Hitchcock, Giallo, Dracula again for obvious reasons, and Dark Glasses. So yeah, the fact that this actually is a little bit more of a complete retrospective, and it goes a little bit further and it gives you like insight into each one. I think it's a perfect introductory piece for that. Cause I mean, you know, like I said, I've seen just about everything and I mean, I learned a few facts, so it's a perfect, and it's one of the best, you know, introductory documentaries I've seen.
Yep. Agreed. So everyone check it out. And I mean, not only that, the doc, but it also is accompanied by like at least a good handful of Argento movies. I know there is an actual Argento section on Shudder, so you can scroll through that and like pick out movies they talked about in the documentary and kind of go from there. So yeah, you can't really go wrong either way. So with that said, before we get out of here, let's find out if we have anything else for people to listen to. Venom, do you have anything?
Pretty much the same thing we had last week. Latest episode of No More Room in Hell presents Creature Comforts. Episode 23 is still our latest episode where we looked at Dog Soldiers. Our next episode, which will be the March episode, we have decided to, since it is Women in Horror Month, we have decided to do a more female-centric horror movie, a creature feature, obviously. We're still kind of deciding. We've narrowed it down to about two or three, but yeah, that'll probably be our March episode, something with a female creature in it, or at least a female-centric creature feature. So look out for that. Unfortunately, the main show did get postponed this week, but it was for a valid reason. One of us lost power this weekend, so obviously if one of us can't make it, it's going to be hard to do a full main show. You know, fresh cuts we might be able to get away with just a couple, but with the main show, you know, a lot of talking and you know, we've all been on every episode, so, you know, we tend not to record with when one of us is missing. So hopefully this coming weekend we'll get that episode recorded. And I am actually very happy to announce the return of the Crystal Lake Gift Shop. I know it's been, man, it's been almost a year since we've done an episode, and we're very excited to get back to it. We're going to be recording this weekend. At this point, we are up to episode 4 of the Friday the 13th series, so that'll be the episode that we review on this latest episode of the Crystal Lake Gift Shop. Once again, our friend Lacey Liu will be joining us for the third episode in a row on that one. So I'm very excited to get back to that show and get back to watching the quote-unquote classic Friday the 13th, the TV series. Classic to some, you know, garbage to others, but, you know, it still holds a place in all our hearts. So, yeah, very happy that that podcast is going to be coming back. We record this weekend, and hopefully that episode will be out the following week. And that's about all I have.
All right. How about you, Don?
Yeah. Like you said, latest episode of Creature Comforts. I think we have maybe 4 or 5 titles in play for the next episode, which should be, you know, winding down sooner rather than later. I'm still on the latest episode of the main show, Double Bill of Hammer Goodness. So definitely check that one out. The latest episode of the Horror Countdown is also available. I take a look at my top 10 favorite claustrophobia-inducing films, or, you know, claustrophobic films as the title shows. But, yeah, that one was a lot of fun. I got some pretty good topics out of that, so go ahead and check that one out. And I can say the latest episode of the podcast, Would You Die, features myself. It's sort of a quid pro quo from the last episode of Horror Countdown, where that host was on my show, and I returned the favor with him, and we discussed Godzilla in general. So if you weren't tired of us hearing about it for 3-4 months on Creature Comforts, you got a full-on Godzilla show. So go ahead and check that one out. You can find it pretty much everywhere. It's Would You Die podcast. So available pretty easily. But, yeah, just waiting around on the last 2 or 3 episodes to come out. I'm told one is supposed to come out pretty soon. So I'll definitely be on the lookout for that one. But like I said, since we're – I went through a state last year of announcing shows for about 3-4 months. Not going to do it until I officially get the go-ahead. So hopefully I'll get another one out there soon enough. But until now, that's pretty much it for me.
All right. I'm pretty much empty except the shows we do. So hopefully by the time we're recording the next Fresh Cuts, we will have recorded the new Friday the 13th series episode, which Venom mentioned. And we have our episode of the main show rescheduled as well. So if all goes well, next week will be like a huge release week for the network, or I guess family of podcasts on the No More Room in Hell YouTube channel, and you know, everywhere else we can be heard. But with that said, yeah, our next episode, I already forgot the name of the movie, but it's the killer toy teddy bear.
Imaginary.
One, right? Imaginary. I think that's what comes out this week, right?
Yes, Friday. Already got my ticket.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah, if all goes as planned, that should be our next episode. And hopefully, because while there's no guarantee that's going to be good, we need a week off from VOD. We just do. So, yeah, let's cross our fingers that's at least good, I guess. But with that said, thank you, everybody, for listening. We're going to get out of here. Let's say bye to our listeners.
Later.
Arrivederci, paisanos.
Peace.